It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at the Voyager probe's journey through the solar system, and now beyond the solar system, according to an announcement yesterday from NASA.
First, firearms in Wisconsin. A story from Appleton last weekend is hitting the statewide papers today.
Two men were on their way to the Appleton Farmers Market, openly carrying rifles and holstered handguns. Police confronted them, held them at gunpoint, and handcuffed them. Eventually released them after checking that the guns were owned legally. One of the men recorded the event. The incident has gotten people talking.
Well, what do you think about this story? Should people openly carry firearms in public, and should the police confront them when they do? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can feel free to post on the Central Time Facebook page. Nick Clark is with us now. He's president of Wisconsin Carry Incorporated. Nick, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Now, you heard our little rundown of the story. I'd like to hear it in your words. Can you describe what happened, please?
Sure. Well, I became aware that a few gentlemen from Appleton went to the farmer's market. I think it was last week, Thursday or Friday, so about a week ago. And they open carried, one of the guys open carried his AR-15 with a holstered handgun on the side. The other one, I believe, just open carried his AR-15. And so they were headed over to the farmer's market and stopped by police around five or six minutes into their walk from where they parked to the farmer's market. And from that point, the situation evolved from there.
And as far as the legality of what they were doing, it's legal to carry firearms in Wisconsin, right?
Yeah, it's perfectly legal to carry a firearm in Wisconsin, both, you know, obviously openly without a permit, concealed with a permit. You know, certainly when people are hunting, they're open carrying rifles. As far as handguns go, before Act 35, Wisconsin's concealed carry law, open carry was the only way that we could carry handguns. So that was several years before concealed carry became legal. We open carried here in Wisconsin as the only way to carry.
Now, this didn't turn into a huge event, but these men were stopped by police and they were, you know, they were talked to. The police assessed what they were doing with these weapons and, you know, kind of went from there. A lot of audio was recorded from the incident. Where do you think the event went after that in terms of how the police responded to these two men?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I would have an issue with, you know, as an organization, we don't encourage people. We advocate that people do two things. And first is that you abide the law, so do things within the realm of the law. And second would be that they carry in the manner of their choosing. We don't endorse open carry or concealed carry. And the same thing goes with your choice of weapon. We don't, you know, advocate that people carry any particular type of weapon. But those are our two considerations as an organization. In this case, the disturbing thing from my standpoint is that police, we expect our members, we expect citizens to operate within the law, but we also expect the police to do the same thing. And police have to have reasonable suspicion in order to stop someone, detain them without their consent. In order to stop someone and have a consensual conversation, they can do that. So I wouldn't blame the police for if they get a man with a gun call showing up and driving over there, observing what's going on, making sure that the guys don't look suspicious, that they're not threatening anybody. Now, if they got a call and someone said, hey, these guys are pointing guns at people and saying, I'm going to shoot you, that's a whole different story. But if they have a call, if there's guys walking down the street with guns over their back in a sling, doing nothing else wrong, I wouldn't be surprised if the police would respond, but I would be surprised, and I was surprised, if the police pulled their guns on them, handcuffed them, detained them for 45 minutes because they had done nothing wrong. That's where I believe the stop really took a turn for the worse in terms of police behavior.
Now, real quick, I want to get to our callers, which we have, but the guns they were carrying, handguns, and also a kind of semi-automatic weapon, right? Is that part of what happened here?
Yeah, they had one gentleman had a handgun on his hip in a holster, and both had rifles over their back with a sling. So they weren't carrying them in their hands, but over a sling on their back.
But correct. The rifles were semi-automatic weapons. Have I got that right?
The rifles, handguns, they were all semi-automatic weapons. Most guns carried for self-defense are semi-automatic.
All right, let's take a phone call. We've got Paul calling from Barron, Wisconsin. Hey, Paul.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm okay. What do you think?
Yeah, I've got a little bit of an opinion. I've watched, I guess you could say I watch a lot of YouTube. I'm going to pull over here so I don't lose your signal. I watch a lot of YouTube, and I see a lot of these videos of these guys that are essentially baiting the police, and they use this open carry right as kind of an excuse to carry around ridiculous firearms. Now, I have a CCW, and I do carry a weapon when I can, but I don't believe that these guys are really doing it for the right reasons. They're really doing it to bait the police. If you really need to carry an AR-15 for self-protection, you're way overstepping what you need. A simple pistol, if you really feel like your safety is something that needs to be protected, a simple pistol will do the trick, and there's really no reason to have that outside of concealment. If you're not allowed to conceal a weapon, maybe that's a different case. But an AR-15, I just can't buy into that. I think it's overkill.
All right, Paul, thank you so much for the call. And what do you think, Nick?
Well, I'm glad that was the first call, because it really gets to the crux of the issue here. And the first mistake that a lot of people make is that they're going to guess what the motivation was for these guys carrying the way that they did. And that's a mistake. I've spoken to the guys, and I know for a fact their attempt was not to bait the police. I can say that with absolute certainty. I'm confident that they did expect that they might talk to the police during going to the farmer's market at some point. That's the reason that they carried voice recorders with them. We who open carried before Act 35 was legal often had encounters with police, and it was just a real good practice. So it's common practice for people who open carry, period, to carry a voice recorder. Now, I personally don't, but many people do, just because if it ever came down to, there's people who are open carrying and the police said, oh, you were concealed carrying, your coat fell over it, and they like to have all their conversation recorded just in the event that they have something to back up what they said. So that was the first thing that jumps out to me, is I think people make a mistake of guessing what their motivation was. Baiting the police, absolutely not. I think that they were surprised that the police reacted the way they did. They weren't surprised that the police showed up. But when it comes to choice of weapon, I mean, in reality, the only difference between the semi-automatic guns that they carried on their backs and the ones that the one gentleman had on his hip was just the size. They're both just as deadly. One held a few more rounds, but it's really just a matter of the visual. But I
All
think,
right.
People
Let's
are
hold it there and take a few more calls. We've got a lot of people waiting to talk. John is next in Racine. Hi, John.
Well, I'm a person who was trained with rifles and pistols by the NRA and a marksman. I hunt. I own quite a few guns, rifles, and handguns. And three quick points. First is, basically, your position is people should carry any gun they want, anywhere they want, and any time they want. And I think you and your group are irresponsible in making that judgment. I can't imagine to tell me what the people feared and needed an AR-15 for to go to a farmer's market. Secondly, it shows the problems with this law and with our lawmakers, who simply are pandering to a small, loud minority of people when the general public is opposed to this kind of behavior. And third, I'm happy the police did hassle, and I haven't seen the videos or arrest these people, because they have to make a judgment at the time to protect the people. They have an individual, personal responsibility to protect the people of their community, and I think they did just that. I hope other police follow the same pattern.
All right. Thank you so much for that call, John. And, Nick, you want to respond to John?
Yeah. Well, a lot of people think that because they own a gun means that they're, they have the right to make a judgment on these kinds of situations. People can carry in the manner they're choosing, and we don't say they can carry any place, any time, any type of weapon, but we do think that it's up to people to choose, and it's not for John to decide what someone else should be carrying. I'm going to be completely honest. If I was in the Colorado theater, I would have wished for an AR-15 in my hand if that guy came in. Now, I wouldn't have been carrying one because it wouldn't have been practical, but I would have wished for one. We've got a gentleman who was riding his bike in Sheboygan Falls, going from his house to the range out of town, and he had a .22 caliber AR-15 style gun over his back. I don't want that kid to be, I call him a kid, he's 21. I don't want him to be stopped by the police and have a gun pointed at him because he's going from his house to a range on a bike with a legally carried gun on his back. So I think that John isn't thinking of the bigger picture when he's okay with the police pointing guns at anybody. If John was a real gun owner, he would understand that the fundamental rule of fire and safety is you don't point your gun at anything you don't want to destroy. And you shouldn't be pointing, the police should not be pointing their guns at people who are doing nothing illegal and threatening no one.
Nick, if this was a demonstration of Second Amendment rights and, you know, within Wisconsin's legal jurisdiction, what about the critique from some of the law enforcement that, you know, we are living in an era post-Columbine, post-Sandy Hook, and people are jumpy, and maybe this wasn't the time or the place to be exercising those rights?
I think that's precisely the reason why something like this creates a good conversation, because the AR-15 style gun has been demonized by the media, and I don't call you in particular, but by the national media on the news for the past, you know, almost a year now. And it's important that people understand that, hey, this is the most popular gun in the country, and it's not just bad guys that carry them, it's good guys too. Now, I agree that most people wouldn't carry it to a farmer's market, and I personally wouldn't carry it to a farmer's market, but I don't think there would have even been a disturbance with guys going to a farmer's market. The disturbance was only where the police were. I bet you if they'd have been able to go onto the farmer's market, they'd have bought their cucumbers and been on their way, and people would have looked and noticed, but there would have been no disturbance. People try to compare this to yelling fire in a theater, which it's not that at all. If you yell fire in a theater, people are going to get hurt. If these guys walk through the farmer's market with guns in their back, no one is going to get hurt.
Nick, real quick, we're just about out of time, but have we seen the end of this, or is there going to be legal action?
Well, there's a couple things that disturb us. First, obviously, that we don't believe the police had reasonable suspicion to stop these guys. If they wanted to stop and talk to them, I'm sure the gentleman would have had a consensual conversation. But stopping them at gunpoint and putting them in handcuffs without any reasonable suspicion of a crime, that's concerning. The second thing was they threatened the guys with arrest if they were to proceed on to the farmer's market. That's concerning to us because it's not lawful for the police to prohibit them from carrying in a public space that doesn't qualify as a special event. So on the audio recording, they were threatened with arrest, and that's concerning to us. I just want to make sure that the Appleton police understand the law better in the future so that they don't try to arrest people who legally carry, whether that's a rifle or just a pistol on their side.
Okay. Well, Nick Clark, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Veronica.
That was Nick Clark, president of Wisconsin Carry Incorporated.
Coming up next, the epic journey of the Voyager probe. It's out of the solar system.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, it's confirmed. Yesterday, NASA announced that Voyager 1 has gone where no probe has gone before.
The actual date it left our solar system was August 25th of 2012, last year, but it's taken a lot of months of research to confirm that.
Elizabeth Howell joins us now. She's a journalist specializing in space exploration. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me, Veronica.
So this seems like a pretty momentous moment. We've got Voyager 1 leaving the solar system. How big a deal is this to you?
It's a huge deal because we launched this probe 36 years ago, and it really was only designed for about 5 years. The idea was that they were going to be taking a look with this particular one at the planets of Jupiter as well as Saturn, and then they just were going to see how long this thing would last. And then as the decades wore on, they began to see some interesting things. They were noticing that the magnetic particles around it began to change. They saw the plasma concentration, the superheated gas was also changing. And then finally, in the last, I guess about 6 months to 12 months, there was a feeling that maybe something might be a little bit different, that perhaps we were not seeing so much the influence from the sun anymore, but all the stars that are sort of out there in the universe. And that's when the investigations really began to happen. There's been a lot of debate about whether it's in, whether it's out, but now with this latest finding, we can definitely say that, yes, it is in interstellar space.
And Voyager 1 launched in what? Was it 1977?
It was in 1977 that it launched, and it made a lot of neat discoveries along the way. For example, when it was passing by Jupiter, it took pictures of a lot of the moons, and it found that Io, which is one of the moons there, is volcanic. And the reason it's volcanic is the moon goes around Jupiter quite quickly, once every 42 hours, and the immense gravity from Jupiter, it's the biggest planet in our solar system, is actually flexing the planet, almost like a ball, like squeezing a ball. And by doing that, you get this magma that's building up inside and also erupting on the surface. And that's what made it so interesting, because we never had seen any of these close-up pictures before. Before, we saw these moons in the sky, but they just were dots to us. And then when the probe actually flew by, it began to see them as little worlds of their own. Another example was when it headed out to Saturn a few years later, it noticed that a lot of the moons out there seem to have evidence of ice. For example, on Enceladus, they saw all these cracks there, and they supposed there must be fissures. And it would be from the same process, they say, from this gravity, the dense gravity of Saturn flexing it.
Well, it's interesting. I was reading a little bit about it. It sort of seems like, you know, a Pinto of space probes because it's got an 8-track tape on it. It's got super slow computers, and yet it's out there plugging away.
It's still plugging away. And another thing on board, actually, is a golden record, which was created to really broadcast what humans are to whoever, what sort of being would find it. And so on this golden record, as it's called, they have the greetings in many, many languages. They have sounds such as humpback whales and other various things you hear on Earth, like probably the traffic that you hear behind me might be on there. And it also has a map that would show any sort of celestial being where we might be. And it is incredible that it has survived for so long. In fact, it's not even as strong as a light bulb, the signal that's coming from Voyager, and it takes many, many hours to get to Earth. And just the fact that we can even hear this thing is a testament to technology. It takes a really, really big radio dish. In fact, there are about three of them that NASA uses in association with other countries to just keep track of this thing. And I think that it's incredible that they're able to even see it and hear from it after so many years.
Yeah, so what kinds of things are we expecting it to hear back as it sends us information?
Well, what we're going to be trying to figure out is what's going on with the magnetic field, because from what I can tell, they were expecting that the magnetic particles around it were going to be changing once it began to get out into interstellar space, but they haven't really seen as much of that as they expected. But the good news is there still are several years left in the expected power that it has on there. It's run by a little nuclear reactor. They believe that it's going to be able to transmit information from its instruments through until about 2025. That's when the last one is going to be shut off. And then afterwards, they still will be able to take a look at it just in terms of engineering data, making sure that its internal environment is working okay for about the next 5 or 10 years. And then it will just be a silent emissary from humanity sailing out from the solar system out into the universe. It's going to pass by another star in about, I think it's 42,000 years, if I have that correctly. It'll be about 1.7 light years from the star, though, so nothing close. And then after that, it will just start orbiting the center of the Milky Way and doing that for millions of years, as far as we know. We will be able to keep track of it, though, by that point.
Wait, we will be able to keep track of it?
We won't.
I was going to say, I wish we could.
I'd so, love to see what it says.
That's what we expect it to do, but we're not going to be able to figure it out. It could have adventures. It will have adventures that we'll never know about.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to be, maybe we could send somebody out there to go and pick it up after a while, or at least just to wave at it, because it would sure be neat in a few hundred years once we have the technology to head out that way to see what it's capable of, what it's seeing.
And Voyager 1 has a buddy. Voyager 2, it sounds like, is also on the course to reach interstellar space.
Yes, Voyager 2 is was actually launched first, but it's not moving as quickly as Voyager 1, which is why it is still behind. But eventually, yes, it will be reaching the same threshold. And the good thing is that with a second spacecraft that's heading out there, that's when you get confirmation. The good thing about science is when you have one thing that's happened, that's good, but then it's better if you have it happen again. So when Voyager 2 actually reaches that threshold, and I'm not sure exactly when that will be, but probably sometime in the next few years before the instrument shut off as well, that'll be an exciting moment, because then they can look at the data that it produces compared to the data that they have on Voyager 1 and then say, this is the way that things are, or maybe that there are some serious things that we don't even know about yet. I'm excited for when that moment happens.
Now, some of the mysteries of the solar system that are still sort of lingering out there are questions like dark matter. What is it? You know, where do we find it? Is that any kind of something that these Voyagers could help us with, or is that beyond their purview?
It's beyond their purview, and the reason is dark matter, for one thing, is something that we can't detect through any instrument that we have currently. The way that you can see dark matter is through its effects. For example, because it's so massive, it can bend light. And when light is bent, you can measure the amount of the distortion. And by inferring the amount of distortion and sort of measuring it to what we would expect by conventional physics, that's when we come up with the matter for dark matter. So the thing is, we don't even really know exactly how to search for dark matter because we don't know what it's made of. All we know is that it's probably something that is responsible for making the universe expand a bit quicker than what we thought. The big discovery a few years back was that the universe was accelerating in an expansion. We knew the universe was expanding for a while, but then we found that something was stepping on the accelerator. We didn't know what was going on. And that's when this idea of dark matter, there are a few other ideas as well, but when the idea of dark matter began to come in. And this was such an astounding discovery, actually, that the universe was getting faster at getting bigger than before, that they won a Nobel Prize for it a couple of years ago. So it's a big unanswered question. What's going on? Why is it getting faster? What is it made of? And I wish that the Voyagers were able to take a look at this, but it may take another spacecraft or another telescope to really come up with the answer.
Elizabeth, do you think this is the future of space exploration, unmanned space probes that can last a lot longer than a manned mission could?
it depends on what you're trying to do. If you want to be heading out into interstellar space, for the moment it's very difficult for humans to do it because there's just all the life support systems. There is, of course, ideas that you can maybe freeze these people for a while, but we haven't got that technology figured out yet. So it's probably going to take, you know, a few decades at the very least to get to that sort of thing. But when it comes to actually going to a nearby world, such as Mars or maybe back to the moon or to an asteroid, that's when a human would come in and maybe a little bit more handy because the voyage there would not take too long. You wouldn't have to worry about all the big life support systems. And also, it's just a little bit easier to communicate with a human on another world. Like, for example, we have the Mars Curiosity rover sitting on Mars right now. And there's usually, you know, on average, 20-minute time delay between Earth and Mars. And that makes it difficult to get any sort of command from here to there because, you know, what if it was beginning to go over a cliff at the worst situation? By the time you say stop, it already has fallen over. So what they have to do is they need to analyze the images every single day and then decide to send a sequence of commands that will just make it crawl forward, you know, a little bit, a few feet at a time.
And I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. We're out of time, but obviously a lot of fascinating stuff to come. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Howell is an award-winning freelance journalist specializing in space.
Coming up next, is there a point when cartoon characters and robots get a little too realistic and start to get a little creepifying? It's the Uncanny Valley, coming up here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. A little later in the program, we'll be joined by WPR's news guy, Noah Ovshinsky. He'll give us a recap of the state's top news stories from this week.
First, this music is putting us in the mood to talk about robots and the like. Have you ever watched an animated movie and felt a little creeped out because the characters are a little too realistic looking? There's a chance you've fallen into what they call the uncanny valley, the idea that more lifelike a creation, an animated character, robot, the more likely it is to cross the line from cute to creepy.
Our next guest, this has been the golden rule for robotics for decades, but questions are now being raised as to whether the uncanny valley actually exists.
Joining us now is Rose Eveleth. She's a producer, writer, and designer based in Brooklyn. Her piece, Robots, Is the Uncanny Valley Real?, appeared on BBC.com. Rose, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's the history? Where did the idea of the uncanny valley come from?
So the idea was originally proposed by a Japanese scientist called Masahiro Mori in 1970. Some people will point back to 1906 when a philosopher, Ernst Jentsch, wrote about it, but really what we think of as the uncanny valley was proposed in the 70s. And the surprising thing about it was that it was proposed and then sort of never questioned. Everyone just sort of, I guess, read it and thought, yeah, you know, that makes sense. And it wasn't until recently that people started to actually look into whether this was a single phenomenon or even real at all.
So the notion, and I think I explained it right, is that as you take a cartoon character from, say, looking like Charlie Brown to looking more and more like a human, you reach a point where it gets creepy. And I'm thinking Polar Express here, which I found a little creepy, and it was trying to get that image captured of what a person looks like. Is that a pretty good summary of what the Uncanny Valley is?
Yeah, exactly. And Polar Express is a classic example that people use. Another one is Final Fantasy from 2001. And this applies to video games, too, and also robots, the humanoid robots that you might see in real life. So, I mean, it sort of cuts across all different kinds of imagery.
And do designers of these various genres say, all right, we need to make things a little less realistic so we don't cross the line there?
Yeah, a lot of them do. There's sort of a split between designers who say, we don't care, we're going to try to make things as realistic as possible. So there are some robot designers who say, no, I'm going to try to make as realistic of a robot as possible. And then there are a lot of people who say the opposite. They say, you know, I'd rather not people be totally repulsed by the thing that I make, and I'm going to try to avoid that. So Pixar is a classic example of that. They often sort of skew to the more cartoon side of things to avoid falling into sort of the Polar Express trap of making these characters that are just too lifelike for us.
Well, that's the idea, but you write that the Uncanny Valley, the problem with it is that it's an inherently woolly idea. What do you mean by that?
So the really interesting thing about the Uncanny Valley is that the first paper, this paper from 1970, wasn't even really a scientific paper to begin with. It was sort of a proposal. It was Mori saying, I think that this is what it's like, and here's a graph that I think is going to describe how people feel. It was originally written in Japanese, and in fact, the translation, the Uncanny Valley, the translation of that, is debated. The actual translation that's closest to reality is the Valley of Eeriness. And there's a big question about what it means for something to be uncanny and whether or not the translations that we've used, things like uncanny and likability, like how much we like something, are the right ones to be using. And for a scientist, when you're looking at a complex emotion like that weird feeling that we feel when we see a Polar Express or a humanoid robot, they're trying to figure out if it's one phenomena or more than one. And it's hard to do that when no one's even defining the emotion the same way. And so that's what makes it sort of a very difficult concept to even look into, because you've got all these people who are now looking at it, but they're all working from something that's a translation of something that wasn't even particularly precise to begin with.
So it ended up being this folklore, but that a lot of people took for granted as a proven scientific thing.
I think so, yeah. I mean, a lot of the scientists that I talked to for this were surprised at how little research had been done into it. A lot of them talked about how when they got interested, the first thing you do is you look up to see what other people have done before you. And more than one of them said they were totally shocked that very little, in fact, had been done before them, and that people had just sort of accepted this as something that was true.
So are these scientists that you talk to, are they trying to study this concept, and how do you do that?
Yeah, they're definitely trying, and it's very hard. A lot of it has to do with really setting definitions properly and figuring out what it is you're even studying to begin with, right? You need to know what you're measuring before you can measure it. And anytime you're trying to measure something like that weird feeling you get, you know, even when you or I were to try to describe it, we're just sort of like, I don't know, I just don't like it, you know? So it's hard to, as a scientist, put, you know, data on that. So there's a couple of ways that they'll do it. What they'll do is they'll show people sort of a progression of images, and they'll take, on the one side, they'll have a very cartoon blob thing, and on the other side, they'll have a picture of a human, and then they'll kind of morph that into 10, 20 different little images, and they'll ask people to kind of rate their reaction to each one. And the idea being that it somewhere in the middle there, as you go from this cartoon character to a human, you're going to see that dip in likability, in our reaction. And that's one way they do it. And they've tried to do this with monkeys and with babies, even, to try to figure out whether this is sort of an inherent revulsion that we have, or whether it's tied up in sort of the way we find we're afraid of robots culturally or things like that. So that's one way they'll do it. A lot of it is just showing people pictures of things. And this is what Moore even proposed. You know, he showed a picture of a wooden hand, which in the 70s was like pretty uncanny to people, which now we would find sort of normal. And he proposed even showing people. So a lot of it is showing people pictures or having them interact with robots and responding to them, which makes it hard because we humans are not very good at providing very accurate data for scientists about how we're feeling.
Yeah, this subject 13 has a creeped out factor of 0.73. That's probably a phrase you didn't come across a lot. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
You mentioned the idea of this being inherent, and that's why they're trying to study on babies, versus something that we pick up and culturally learn. Is it possible that this we might have had this aversion when we first saw a robot or a really lifelike motion-captured animated character, but we're going to get used to it and get over it?
Yeah, so scientists are split on that. Some people say that, you know, we're going to be able to make robots that are so lifelike, that are so human, that we don't even know that they're robots. And this is sort of the classic sci-fi scenario, right? You have robots among us and we don't know who they are. And there are some scientists who say we're going to get that good at it. And then once we do, all of this sort of weirdness that comes from robots, which a lot of it they say is sort of, it's so close yet not quite there, and our reaction is almost one of like, maybe that's a sick individual, maybe that's an individual that I don't want to be near because they might give me some sort of disease. That as soon as we get good at making robots move like humans and look like humans, we're just going to get over this whole thing and it won't even be an issue. The other camp says no. Just like, you know, if you're an expert in something, you can get really, really good at telling the difference between tiny factors, you know, biologists who can tell the difference between all the different kinds of insects, and you and I have no idea, they just look like bugs. they're saying, you know, because being able to identify something as human is pretty important to us as humans, we're going to just keep up and we'll just be able to figure it out. And there will never be that moment where we can just look at something that's a robot and say, oh, yes, it's a robot, it's almost like a human, but I'm fine with it. That they argue that we're always going to be able to know when something is a robot.
Well, here's an interesting thought, or I think it's interesting. Are we going to learn things from these robot and animated character studies that then tell us things about how we recognize other actual humans? Can we feed that research back?
I think so. And I think a lot of people who study especially how babies start to learn what's a human face and what's not a human face, a lot of the studies are quite similar. You know, you show a baby a human face and then you show it a not human face. And that's also how we look at whether or not they're registering this uncanny valley feeling. And I think that for a lot of people, there are a lot of interesting components to this. Like, for example, one of the robots that I got to look at is named Casper 2, and he's a child robot, so like doubly creepy for most of us. But for a lot of kids, he's not creepy at all. And that's really interesting to scientists, you know, and especially because Casper 2 is a robot that's designed to work with autistic children. And autistic children respond really well to this robot. So that's interesting. So there's a lot of things that we can learn, I think, from the way that we respond to these robots about how not only how we interact with other humans, but also how we interact with technology and how we're changing the way that we feel, how comfortable we feel with like a robot being in the room.
So you've been researching the robots, the movies. Is there a case of one that you personally, Rose, were a little creeped out by?
I think a lot of them were creepy at the beginning to me. Casper was a good example. When I first saw him, I was like, oh, I don't like that. But as soon as you sort of get used to it, and it only takes a few minutes of looking at it or watching a video of it, it sort of goes away. And a lot of robot designers that I talked to said that, you know, even the man who built Casper, who sort of turned him on for the first time, said that even he, after working with him all these years or all this time to build it, was a little bit creeped out by Casper when he started moving. But then you get over it. So for me, there were a lot of robots that I saw that I thought were creepy and then sort of no longer were creepy. And I think that might be something that just sort of happens culturally as well, is we're so used to seeing robots, if we get good at building them, we're so used to seeing them all the time that eventually we just sort of stop feeling that sort of revulsion and like being creeped out by them.
Rose, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rose Eveleth. She's a writer, producer, and designer based in Brooklyn. Her piece, Robots, Is the Uncanny Valley Real?, appeared on BBC.com. We've got that linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, our news guy Noah Ovshinsky is here to bring us up to speed on the state's top news stories. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, is here with us now to catch us up on what made headlines this week in Wisconsin. His official title is WPR's Assistant News Director. Noah, it's good to see you.
It's good to be here. Happy Friday.
So I am detecting a theme here in Wisconsin news, and it seems to be a liquid theme. You might call it a watery theme.
Indeed, indeed. This was the week of water, as far as news in Wisconsin is concerned. The First Lady, Michelle Obama, visited our own Watertown here in Wisconsin this week. It was part of a national effort, really, to get more people to drink water.
All right. And she showed up in Watertown. Why did she pick Watertown?
Well, I mean, the name, it seems
besides
obvious.
Besides that.
Yeah, it seems obvious. But the word on the street is the reason why she picked it was because in 2010, actually, Watertown was recognized as having the best tasting water in the state in a competition. I think actually Madison won this past year, but Watertown won in 2010.
And this Drink Up campaign, tell us a little bit about that. What do we know about what she said?
Right. So it's really a natural extension of her signature campaign, her effort as First Lady. It's called Let's Move Initiative. And like many First Ladies, she has picked, you know, a policy or policies that she likes to champion. And in this case, it's childhood obesity. She wants to deal with that issue. And this Drink Up campaign is part of that. The theory being that the more water you drink, the healthier you'll be.
And to be clear, this is not, you know, an anti-soda, any other beverage campaign.
No, it's just pro-water. It is pro-water. In fact, the campaign itself is working with the American Beverage Association and bottled water companies. So this is a very pro-water campaign, not anti-anything. Anything.
Okay. Shemaine Mills went to report on that. Did she say a lot of people turned out?
You know, I don't know the size of the crowd. It was at the high school there. And of course, because she's, you know, a celebrity, obviously. You know, there was a lot of excitement and you know, the high schoolers, the students really responded to her. And of course, she's a very dynamic public speaker. So from what I hear, it was from that perspective, a great event.
All right. So we go from drinking water to water in the Great Lakes. What's happening with the Great Lakes?
Which we sometimes drink.
This is true.
Or not.
Intentionally or otherwise.
Right, or not. Yeah, this was a big week in the Great Lakes. There was a big conference in Milwaukee this week. It was a gathering of policymakers and bureaucrats and scientists and everybody from surrounding states that have a border on the Great Lakes came to this conference to talk about various policy issues, as well as the health of the Great Lakes.
Well, what can you tell us about how the lakes at large are doing? You know, Superior is one we are closely connected to in Wisconsin, Michigan, of course. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there are a few issues that we should touch on when we talk about this conference. One is water levels. You know, we talk a lot about water levels here on Wisconsin Public Radio. They're up, they're down, they're up, they're down. Although if you look historically, the Great Lakes levels are low. As of now, Lake Superior is pretty close to its average for this time of year. So Lake Superior is, from a water level perspective, pretty healthy. The other Great Lakes are doing better. They are still generally down compared to their average lake levels, but they are doing better. So that's good. Now, of course, when we talk about water levels in the Great Lakes, especially at a place, a gathering of politicians and stakeholders and scientists, we talk about the control of lake levels in the state. Conversation almost always turns to that. And the question right now, really facing a lot of people involved with the Great Lakes, is do we do anything to artificially manipulate the water levels? Now, some lakes can be manipulated. Others, like Lake Michigan and Lake Huron, can't be. And so the question facing policyholders, and of course there was conversation about that, is whether or not we should build some sort of structure to prevent more water from leaving Lake Huron through Lake the St. Clair River, which flows into Lake Erie. Some people think that essentially all this water is leaving Lake Huron into Lake Erie because this river is so big. It's allowing so much water out of the lake, sort of like a drain in a bathtub. Hmm. And so that's always a controversial issue. Some people think we should prevent as much water from going through the river. Others think no. Let's let nature take its course.
And sounds like that's an issue that's still on the table.
Yeah, absolutely. TBD. Yeah, it is. And it involves, not only does it involve multiple stakeholders, you've got, you know, people who own property on the Great Lakes. You've got, not only do you have the state governments, but you also have two national governments. You've got the Canadian government and, of course, in the United States government, which also have to make decisions about if we're going to manipulate the water levels in those two lakes.
All right. And something else we're worried about hasn't been an issue necessarily in the Great Lakes, I gather, is carp. But we're worried that the carp are going to make their way to the lakes.
Of course, this is one of those hot issues, has been for years in the Great Lakes, sort of Great Lakes community. And we did get an update of sort of where we're at with that. John Goss, who is the federal government's, I'll call them the carp czar, the person who heads up the federal government's response to Asian carp.
I'm sure he'd love that title.
And I other people call him that.
So okay,
It's not just me. Other people do.
The carp czar.
He is the carp czar, and he said that, you know, they've made an effort, especially the Illinois Department of Natural Resources has really been trying to make an effort to get human placed carp, you know, out of ponds and smaller lakes. You know, we talk about carp that's making their way through the Mississippi River system into the Great Lakes. Well, also, people like to introduce carp into other bodies of water. And according to John Goss,
for fishing and
for other forms of recreation. And John Goss, the carp czar, basically said, you know, the DNR is making some pretty good progress in getting those fish out of those areas. He noted that a month ago near Chicago, a huge 82-pound carp was hauled out of an area that was very close to Lake Calumet, which does directly connect to Lake Michigan. And so this is an effort that, you know, of course, they're promoting because it's good news that they're intercepting these fish. But of course, it's bad news that the fish are there.
But how did it get to be 82 pounds? Sounds like it's been there a while.
By eating a lot.
a lot of other fish.
Eating a lot of stuff that other fish like to eat,
which
is part of the problem. I'd also say, too, that like so many things, when we talk about water levels and things like that, of course, there's ongoing debate about what we should do with carp. And there are, you know, several schools of thought. And at a conference like this, you've got one camp saying, let's do nothing. And then we've got another side of the camp saying, you know, let's physically separate the Great Lakes from the Mississippi River to prevent these fish from making their way into Lake Michigan. So, again, an always present controversy there.
And we've talked a little about Superior. You said water levels are stable there. They're where they should. They're at the average. What about Lake Michigan and what we know about the health of Lake Michigan right now?
Yeah, so this is probably not some good news. Bad news, in fact, which is not the opposite of good news. The UW-Milwaukee scientist at this conference this past week said that the ecosystem really in Lake Michigan is completely different than it was 10 years ago. We're not talking about 20 years ago. We're not talking about 100 years ago. We're talking about 10 years. The ecosystem is completely different. We've got multiple threats with Lake Michigan. We've got water runoff, which is a threat to all lakes, but also the Great Lakes, from, you know, farms, lawns, you know, sewage systems. Again, climate change is making that issue even worse, potentially, because we may have more rain, and more rain means more runoff. So that continues to be a threat. We also have very invasive quagga and zebra mussels. Their populations aren't decreasing. In fact, their populations are increasing, and they're spreading around Lake Michigan. And quagga and zebra mussels are really quite harmful to the ecosystem.
What do they do? Do you know?
Yeah, they filter out. They filter out the water, and so although it seems to make the lake look good, they also feed on things that are really valuable to other bigger fish in the lake. You know, so they basically feed on the same things that more beneficial fish like to eat, and so it's affecting fish populations in the lake.
Yeah, this is a bad news, especially Lake Michigan is considered the Great Lake for sports people, and you know, if the general ecosystem has changed that dramatically, you can only wonder what's going to happen to Superior in 10 years down the road. Too.
Right. I mean, quagga mussels and zebra mussels, they affect the lower end of the food chain. And anytime you affect the lower end of the food chain, it affects throughout the entire food chain, all the way from something as small to a small shrimp, all the way up to salmon and trout. It affects everything.
All right, well, let's do a little bit of a turn here. We're going to move from the Great Lakes to a raw milk hearing that happened here in
yes.
the state. And this is another contentious thing we've got going on. Catch us up on that.
Sure. The Senate Committee on Financial Institutions and Rural Services held a hearing this week on a plan that would legalize raw milk sales in Wisconsin. And those would be on-farm sales, not raw milk being sold in supermarkets, but raw milk sold on farms.
And the idea being that it poses a health risk, and the advocates say, no, it's healthier. I want to drink it for my family, and it should be my choice. So what have we heard at this hearing?
Well, exactly. You've got a coalition of medical professionals and farm groups saying this is bad. This is potentially bad for children and human health. They also think that it puts the brand, the Wisconsin dairy brand, at risk, because all it takes is one severe outbreak of illness, and you've hurt the brand, the dairy brand. So farm groups are against it. People who are for raw milk or the sale of raw milk say that it's healthier than pasteurized milk. They also say it's a freedom issue. They should have the choice to produce and sell this if they want to. And for them, it's a major issue.
Any idea what Governor Walker will do if this gets to him?
Well, you know, Governor Doyle vetoed a similar bill, and Governor Walker has not said what he'd do if it reaches his desk.
And just about 30 seconds, real quick, give us the lowdown on this redistricting bill.
Right. You know, the Republican Senator Darrell Schultz and Senator Tim Cullen have brought about a proposal during a press conference this week that essentially takes the responsibility of redrawing congressional districts and, you know, assembly districts out of lawmakers and into the hands of a nonpartisan agency. They're proposing taking the politics out of redistricting. It's an issue that so far has been met with a cold shoulder, although they did just unveil a proposal essentially this week.
So we'll be watching that one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Noah, thank you so much for stopping by.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
That was Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director.
Coming up, we'll hear about the history of biking in Wisconsin. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.